Today on our show,
we're counting down the top 10 Criterion Collection films
as chosen by patron Etion Filion Save. Let's go, Polly. Welcome to episode 374 of the Countdown Podcast. My name is Wayne.
And my name is Paul. Welcome to the podcast. We count down movies and sometimes television in order of awesomeness, so you don't have to. And today is a patron-directed countdown. This one from Itchion, who is a top-level patron of the show, and he said, how about you do some class?
Yes.
How about you get involved in the Criterion Collection films? Now, Wayne.
Yes.
How many? No, don't answer that question. Criterion Collection is, of course, an American homemade distribution company that focuses on licensing, restoring, and distributing important classic and contemporary films. It's widely renowned among the cinephiles of the world as being kind of the highest class of release that you can get.
So, okay, so
it has to be a
like
very
a...
important film
yes.
in one way, shape, or another. Contemporary films, much harder to get on the list. Some years, in recent years, there's been fuck all representation, if I can put it that way.
So this advocacy brand then, if you're in the Criterion Collection, the idea is it's a feather in your cap as a film?
Absolutely.
Because it's considered classy.
Mm,
all right.
Founded in 1984, and it's grown over the years to about 1,000 films, give or take, on this list.
Really? I wonder it took so long to get through the damn thing.
Why not? What, should we do this, Wayne? How many? I didn't. But I do want to shame you.
Fair enough. Here
for our audience. How many of this Criterion Collection had you seen?
Out of the 1,000 odd films,
ish.
I had seen 28.
This is brilliant.
But I will say this. Of the ones that I had seen, a lot of them are, like, a lot of them, on the occasional, like, when I go, okay, I'm going to go art house, or I'm going to try a different film, or some woman makes me do it. a lot of those movies are the ones that I've seen from the Criterion Collection. So, it does have, we can talk about it because we know it's not on our list. It's got, like, The Rock. The Nicolas Cage movie, The Rock, is a Criterion Collection film.
Agreed.
So is fucking Armageddon, which is also not on our list.
We did. We had a bit of a discussion beforehand. Now, to the long-term listeners, to the fans of the show, thank you so much for your support, for your patronage, for being here with us through the years or the months or the weeks even.
Yes.
We have decided of recent times that we're going to steer clear of what we think are the best films in the category. Because we keep coming to the same
one. We don't want to bore you.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about this shit again.
So if you're new to the show, if you're going, Criterion, this sounds fascinating. And you are of the same
sort of... I can't believe they didn't put that one in.
How dare they not have, for example, here's another film I'm going to mention, The Princess Bride. It's not on my list.
It is on mine.
That's fine. The point is, I left it off because I talk about it all the time.
Exactly. So we'll just skip over that one. But yes,
you can talk about it because I talk about it all the time. Not so much you.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Fair enough.
So we're trying to be a little bit more eclectic. We're trying to be a little bit more, let's shine the light on some films we don't talk about as much. That said, I could not have anything that's me on my list. So higher up on the list are films I have mentioned at least maybe two or three times, but not with the regularity of an Armageddon or a Princess Bride or a Rock or the like.
This is the thing. And the result is you get just fun convo about random-ish films, you know? Just, there you go. So it becomes like a fun film discussion, and that's what we're here for. So, back to the show.
Well, great. And on that note then, let's kick it off with a segment that starts every show. It's called The Recount.
Who wants a recount?
Who?
Who? Who? Who?
Who wants a recount?
Who?
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 Who wants a recap?
Who
wants a recap?
Recount time, folks. What's going on, Paulie?
It's all relating to last week's show, the top 10 thrillers from the noughties.
Mm.
And what a wide array of films there were that were represented. Fittingly, then, that after the vote, which has been going on for about 48 hours, we are recording a little earlier today than we normally do on a weekend. Wayne, we could not be separated. 38 votes apiece.
Oh, really? A dead heat.
Dead heat for, I think, the second time this year, which is very early on to have two draws at this point. Stu for the Stuart Orders podcast said, Paul wins with the greatest of ease. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But Timothy Williams said, running scared of Mr. Brooks, and I also like Swordfish.
Yes.
So, cracking codes and BJs with Wayne who gets my vote.
Word.
Mike T, cousin to you, said, fucking Swordfish cunt. You can tell by the derision in my tone.
Yep. I get that.
John Amenta says, Paul's top three saves his list for sure. Identity sucks.
It was Shanta!
P.S. Wayne should just marry Swordfish. It may even be legal in Australia.
That's not bad.
Brilliant comment. Mina Harker, aka Dan, said, ignoring Swordfish, Wayne has a great list. Paul also has a great list. It's a toss-up. Vote for Wayne to make Paul apoplectic.
Ah. Well, something had to. Something
suck
had
a dick
to try.
Suck a dick. Jonas Landon said, Paul has Old Boy, Battle Royale, and Frailty on his list. Wayne Aruzu has Swordfish. No brainer here. I'm not even sure who he voted for.
Obviously Swordfish.
Could be. It could absolutely be.
That's not what he's saying. That's not what he's saying.
Chef Ben Randall from the Inwards podcast said, Paul gets my vote with Memento.
I mean, sure.
David Power, top level patron show, said, well, Paul did have a fuckwad movie on his number six, and Wayne definitely got props for having Mr. Brooks and American Psycho. But this is clearly contentious film of the week. He also had Swordfish, which is tripe. And Running Scared, while solid, is definitely not number one material, especially when you don't even have a mentor on your list. Plus, Paul had Identity, so he wins automatically anyways.
Well, since you voted for Paul, eat my balls.
Good. I'm glad you've joined the array. Oh, here we go. And lastly, Nicole Presley said, my vote is for Wayno. Swordfish is excellent. Running Scared was a bold number one, but in a good way. It's a good movie. Paul had lots of movies I haven't seen, including Memento. How have you not seen Memento?
The point is she voted for me. Thanks, Nick. Actually, I'm turning into Paul here. Who gives a fuck? I'm so glad you guys actually watched and listened.
Yeah, listened is the thing. Thank you so much. Look, that was 38 votes apiece. I think that's the most votes we had in a while.
I know.
I would love to crack the 100 votes in a week.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. So if you are listening to the show, you just never get around to it, make that effort. Let's see if this week is the week we can get to 100 votes.
Absolutely.
Just for the shits and giggles.
Feel free to share it around.
But you know what? Even more important than that, just write a review on whatever platform you're listening to. That's more important than
voting.
That's
probably better. Yeah, let's do that.
Do that instead, and we'll pretend that we got to 100 votes. Whatever we fall short of, we'll say we got 26 reviews or 23 reviews or 400 views if we get negative 300 votes this week.
You know, even though I said I don't care about the score, and I don't, right? I don't think I've won in about 200 weeks.
No, that's not true.
Roughly 300 weeks.
Nah,
possibly 450 weeks.
What, we're not keeping track of the
year anymore.
We're not.
I mean, but I did think I'm like a period, man.
Dead draw,
I'm
man.
Due.
I'm on the wrong screen, so I can't go. Whoa! All right, without any further ado, let's get into it then on the other side of this music cue. The top 10 Criterion Collection films as asked for by Ezio. The Criterion Collection is the subject of this week's countdown.
Very nice.
And it's straightforward. We had the list there. It's on Wikipedia. Thank God. 1,000-ish films. Wayne, what is your number 10 best Criterion Collection film?
Okay, so this is some odd shit that I saw, but it's actually well known. However, I was very into martial arts films as a child.
What? No.
Yes, no surprises there. this film is called Police Story. It is a Jackie Chan film. Now, let me tell you about Police
Never
Story.
Never seen it, but I've heard all about it.
Oh, my God. Jackie Chan actually thinks this is his best film.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
Wow.
So, the plot is, Chan plays a cop. He goes after bad guys.
That's the story?
That's it. That's it. I'm done with my synopsis. That's it.
Does Police Story 2 advance on this plot at all?
Oh, it does indeed. Why complicate the plot with any more than saying he's a cop, there's bad guys, and he fights them? That's what happens, okay? But if I was to go one step further, I would say he fights them in a 9-minute action scene in a shopping center.
That sounds cool.
Dude. He does stunts that no one would try today without air rams and CGI. He just jumps from one floor to another floor and hits someone and kicks someone.
Where did he make most of his films?
Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong. Yeah. Because that's Hong Kong. Like,
this is very Hong Kong cinema. I think
production company. Like, there's no fucking...
They don't get permits, dude. They just go and film somewhere.
There's no guild or what do you call it?
Oh, no. There's no like... Yeah, there's no Actors Guild or
union,
whatever. Yeah,
union, that's what
yeah,
I'm yeah, union that's right. to be like, you cannot fucking ask someone to do that. They will die.
This film, the stunts aren't actually stunts. It's just footage of people getting fucked up when they fall four stories into furniture. Because like, he does this scene.
It's like America's funniest home video, Hong Kong's funniest home videos.
It is. And the thing is, right, even though everything is bullshit because it's just about this, right, when you see the fight scenes, there's a very famous scene in this where there's a shopping center which is like 7 stories tall. In the middle is that, you know, well or whatever, where you have...
Where the escalators go around the outside, or the outside of that hole.
Yep.
So they had this pole that goes from the seventh floor down to the bottom floor,
well,
right?
Because why wouldn't you why make wouldn't every you? Building like a fire station?
Well, their idea was to put LEDs up or whatever and lights and have all this. And the big scene is Jackie Chan jumps off the fucking, like, landing, grabs this thing and slides all the way down, no net, nothing.
Jeez.
And in the meantime, and he's going through all these electrified bulbs that go psh, 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 as he goes down, and it takes forever to come because that's he's sliding down. So he could easily have died. They tried to light it with not enough electricity. They said, "Look, if we don't use full electricity, they won't all
be fine."
So he jumps.
We'll just brown you out.
That's right. And he jumps and he does it, and he goes psh, 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 and you can tell it's a bit of old school Hong Kong cinema because they actually repeat the scene from a different angle three times in the same film just because we spent all our money on this.
Is it like Kaiser Soze dropping the cup 14 times?
That at least was slow-mo. This was like just this scene, then the exact same scene again from a different angle, the exact same scene from a different angle. That's just boom, boom, boom in the show. Okay? Because Hong Kong, baby. All right. But other than that, I will tell you this, though. Even if you don't like martial arts, Jackie Chan films, I was an enthusiast and stuff, you should watch this just to be marvel at what the shit he tried to do here and how many people definitely died on that set.
Don't most of his films end with like a montage of the
all
outtakes?
The fuck-ups.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this one he could only do in one take, I think, and he fucking, yeah. Anyway, so nailed it.
Damn.
There you are. Police story.
My number 10, probably not that similar when I think about it, or you think about it. This is Spinal Tap, directed by Rob Reiner. From 1984,
yes,
mockumentary about a big hair band, metal band, and their trials and tribulations as they try to get big. You know, this goes all the amp goes all the way to 11.
11, yeah,
getting lost in the underground sort of back.
Oh yeah,
alleyways to get to the stage at one particular point. The drummer who gets killed, unfortunately, all throughout. There's so many great jokes. I'd never watched this film until we came to the podcast, and I think we did top 10 mockumentaries or top 10 documentary. I can't remember.
Yeah.
And I watched it, and I was blown away by how good it was and how clever it was. So good that people believe the music from this, which they did create for the show, because they're all
musicians. They do all this
musicians.
Stuff. Christopher Guest, all those guys. Yeah.
So impressive that people thought this was a real band that they just hadn't heard of. Oh, Spy. Okay, well, this sounds good. Yeah, let's give this a bash.
You know, David Caruso says that anyone who has ever tried to start a band or be in a band as a youth has their heart crushed by this movie because they're like, this is exactly what it's like, except funnier.
I think Alanis Morissette might be going, irony. David Caruso's career being crushed by... he got somewhere and then...
I mean, he got somewhere. Yeah. But look, I mean, you know, I mean, he's so lucky if CSI Punani came along. Like, that was like, forget about it. Anyway, sorry. There you go. Nice one.
Very funny film. Very well. I heard just the other day, maybe this is why it's in my subconscious, they're talking about making This is Spinal Tap 2.
Those motherfuckers got to be 80, right?
Well, this is 38 years later from this film made in 1984. Well,
Top Gun Maverick can swing
well,
it.
Well, that's true.
You know
2 years before Top Gun.
Although,
I mean, none of them look like Tom Cruise, let's face it.
But then they don't have to. They'll be like hair bands and all that sort of shit. Ah, cool.
Okay.
All right. By number 9, everyone, I used to date a woman who was very arty-farty, or as you artsy-fartsy, as you say
fair.
In America. Yeah.
Yep.
Now, she led me towards this film, which is a foreign language film. It's called In the Mood for Love. Now,
inconceivable.
Foreign language. Can we just stop?
Hang on a second. I watched these motherfuckers.
Can we just stop,
Let's
please?
Let's not fucking get elitist and Pagula on our
as a podcast, as a community, as a group of listeners, to measure this moment in terms of its
you can eat
incredible,
balls. You can slick on these balls.
Unpredictableness.
Suck on all the nuts.
No one saw this coming, Wayne. Not least of all me.
Well, I'll tell you why that
very
is,
very good film, and that was almost on my list.
Really? Yeah. You like it?
Yeah, it's very good.
Dude, you know what's weird about... the thing that I got about this film, right, is... first of all, sorry. It's about... it's set in, like, 1962, and there's this journalist. His name is Chow, but his name is... it's Tony Leung. Him and his wife move into this Hong Kong apartment, but his wife is away on business, and he meets this other chick who's also got a husband there, and they basically sort of become friends, but then they realize that their respective partners are cheating on them. And they begin to then fall for one another. However, all through the film, they don't fuck.
I know.
They don't fuck at all.
This is
they don't even kiss, man.
This is unrequited attraction.
It is. And the full movie, it's actually a pretty slow movie. I'm going to tell you, it's a slow moving film. But the thing that got me about it, as I'm watching it going, looking at it and looking at it and looking at it, I'm like, wait, almost every scene in this film.
I don't hate this foreign language film.
No. Well, I mean, this is the thing. Like,
that.
I mean, Paul had an advantage because he loves Asian women. So he he gonna flock to shit like this, okay? I'm already Asian. Okay, so but here's the thing, right?
My wife will have words.
I know. And she's Singaporean like me, so we all are homies, man. So every scene in it almost is a frame within a frame. The way he shoots is he shoots in a doorway that has a window in it and the character's in the back. And it's like every single thing is like that. And for some reason, when he breaks away from it, and it's nothing like that. It actually shocks you in turn. Like, you kind of like, what the fuck?
This film is amazing. A cinematic equivalent of Blue Balls.
It is.
You're like, the whole time, come on now. And you, and what it does, and does so skillfully, is it really makes you invested in these two people deserve one another. They should be together.
Yes.
Their spouses are shit.
Yeah.
They're shit individuals, and they're better people than they are. And you just think, oh, because this is, I watch this through the lens of Hollywood or through the lens of English language speaking films. And 98 times out of 100 in these films, they will wind up together and it'll be happily ever after and off they go together. Hooray. Yay.
That's right.
Not this movie.
No. And he does things
where, I know we're spoiling the shit out of it, but this film's like 30 years old.
Yeah. But he'll come like home and, like, you know, he'll go to a place where she was, but she was just there yesterday and he just missed her by a day, or she's there and he doesn't know it's her. All this kind of shit. That's what it does. But it's just masterful the way it happens.
Yeah. The coloring.
The color is it. The way it looks. Yeah. It's so... It's just beautiful. It's not muted. It is bright, but it's somehow rich. It's just really, really cool. So yeah, in the mood for love.
Nice.
May put you in the mood to bust a nut.
Nice choice. My number nine could not be further from that as well. My number nine is a film I recently rewatched. I hadn't seen it, I would say, since the early 90s.
Okay.
And I was too young to appreciate what this film was going for. Now, with the benefit of time. And the advent of the internet, this film feels prescient. And I talked about it a lot on a upcoming episode of the Binge Movies podcast with Jason, friend to the show.
Okay.
Great podcast, great show. You haven't listened to Binge Movies, get on and
damn it, Paul Buster Nut. What's the show?
It's called Videodrome, directed by David Cronenberg from 1983.
Tell me a Videodrome and what it's about.
Stars James Woods, Deborah Harry. And James Wood is he's a owner of a CEO of basically a soft porn cable channel.
I'm intrigued.
And he's trying to find new content and he stumbles across this signal that comes out of where it is, fucking Pittsburgh or Cleveland or some crap like that, that is showing just women being tortured and seemingly murdered.
Oh.
And he's like, well, this is kind of, wow, this shit seems so real and whatever else. And he's reluctantly kind of titillated by this. And so he tries to find out what the origin of this signal is. And Deborah Harry is a radiotherapist and they get involved together and she's a masochist and wants to be hurt and whatever else. So he's kind of drawn into this world.
Right.
And then it gets really surreal into David Cronenberg body horror territory where slits open up in people's stomachs. Ugh. And you insert shit in there that programs them.
That's right. David Cronenberg, that weird motherfucker.
And TVs become like living pulsating organs that you put things into, if I can put it that way.
What? You like this?
It's really, really clever. This is an 83 film, which basically is saying TV is going to take over the world. TV is going to become the new reality. It was wrong in the medium. It was right in the message. The message was the internet.
Mm.
Really, that's how this has become. People are choosing to spend their lives on the internet, which adds this power to it. And I don't want to talk about too much more. You can hear Jason and I talk about it for like 20, 25 minutes, maybe even half an hour. We go on about this film. I was stunned by how much more engaged in this film I was than I expected to be. Oh, I remember watching this. It was weird.
I suppose you could argue that screens were taking over. You know what I mean? Like, so screens now. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. So that's
very, very good horrendous film. You know? And perfect story. James Woods, unlike most of Cronenberg's heroes, is a good actor. And the other exception would be The Fly with
Jeff Goldblum,
also a very good actor. And, of course, Gina Davis as the heroine in that film. Yeah. Watch this movie. If you've never seen it before, it is better than you can imagine for a film that is now almost 40 years old. Yeah.
Videodrome. Mm. Okay. Cool. Well, I was similarly disturbed by my number 8 film. And it may be the only film where just thinking about it kind of makes me cry and remember like every sorrowful ideal of my childhood.
Everyone. Jesus.
Well, just like not every moment, but every like just the idea of how I remember the memory of feeling sad. The movie is Watership Down.
I always put this on there thinking, I'm just going to piss Wayne off.
Dude, Watership Down, all right? First, it's got John Hurt, Denham Elliott. And obviously, it's a famous literature novel, and they made a cartoon out of it. And I thought, because I was a kid, hey, it's a cartoon, and I'm a kid, and I like cartoons. And it's about
rabbits.
But rabbits fucking each other up, man. They're fucking each, like, they're torturing, scaring each other. There's a big crow that says piss off to one of them. Like, all kinds of shit. And like, I remember thinking it was really surreal because it starts with this really odd animation where it talks about the story and then you see them all fucking each other up and stuff. And that Simon and Garfunkel song,
Bright eyes,
your mom likes my... that actually makes me sad every single time. And there's also hunters killing them and this and that. I think I was just like dealing with the idea of death and stuff at the age of whatever I was.
Very, too young.
Too young. And I was like, shit, why? Who let me watch this fucking film? Fucking Asian parents. So anyway,
I'm no James Bond, but that's you're right. Not a good parent.
Exactly. Maybe I'd be James Bond if some motherfucker didn't show this bullshit up in here. Anyway, Watership Down has always been that kind of problem for me. Where I think about it, and I'm a little
obviously effective and obviously a good film.
But that's why it's fucking amazing, because it's like that. So it's like, wow. So anyway, yeah, not all cartoons are for kids, everyone.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. All right, fair enough. My number eight is a much more whimsical, much more twee film.
Uh-oh. I'm hearing a little Wes Anderson.
Which one is it? The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Ah! Go on.
We watched Bottle Rocket earlier in the piece.
That's my number seven.
Okay, all right. So I remember liking Bottle Rocket and thinking, oh, yeah, that's different and interesting and engaging or whatever. And then he made this series of films which just lost me.
Really?
I can't even think of what they were.
And stuff like that, or what?
Look, I don't know if I've seen any. They were so disinteresting to me at that age in my life.
Oh, yeah.
That I just didn't bother. And I fell off the Wes Anderson train. My daughter comes of an age. We watched The Fantastic Mr. Fox. It's interesting and it's a bit different and it's claymation and whatever else. And this is on the IMDb top 250 films of all time. Therefore, as I was working my way through those films, I came to watch it thinking, ugh, whatever. Wes Anderson? At least it's only 100 minutes.
This is my favorite of his.
This film is great. It's just different stories all kind of put together all around this Grand Budapest Hotel. Ralph Fiennes is the concierge?
Yeah,
he's manager.
Of
this hotel. And yeah, he's a concierge. It's the official title, according at least to Letterboxd here. And all the different stories as they go off looking for this famous Renaissance painting and what transpires from that.
And this is him telling his story as a child. Because it's basically flashbacks of that dude who was Flash Thompson in Spider-Man.
And so, F. Murray Abraham. Telling his...
Amadeus,
So it's just so...
You know what it is?
I don't think it's peak Wes Anderson. I think we re-achieved that recently with whatever his most recent film was, which is even more extreme than this film.
The newspaper one, yeah.
Yeah.
The French Dispatch. There you go.
Thank you. Jeez. Mind blank. Excellent when you're a podcaster. Thank you, Wayne, for rescuing me there. I think that one takes these sensibilities to the next level, but this is probably the
most...
This one
works more for me, and I'll tell you why. It's because his Wes Andersonisms in this film, which is changing light really suddenly in stage, so and the characters don't react to it, just for the audience. The little train going up the hill that looks like...
His sensibility of basically dollying left or right and everything changing.
Yes, that's cool.
I love the way that it's... When the still shots, they look like they're framed paintings.
Yes.
Like there's so much effort that goes into that.
French Dispatch is like that. Every scene looks like a child book.
I like French Dispatch illustration, but I think this is better.
Yeah, we swap on that one.
You like French Dispatch better?
No, I like this one better.
That's what I'm saying. I like the French Dispatch, but I like this one better.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Grand Budapest is where he's at.
Mm. All right, great.
Cool. But then my number seven, Bottle Rocket.
Mm, tell us
about the history in this one is that Paul brought the Laserdisc.
Laserdisc
of Bottle Rocket, because that's how old we are. And we didn't know what it was. Wes Anderson, no one ever heard of him. The Owens brothers, none of them. No one. The only person that was in this film is James Caan. And
yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I remember the only reason I think we watched it is I saw Wes Anderson accept an MTV Movie Award for this film. And he said that, James Caan said that, you know, what does Bottle Rocket mean? And I went, I don't know. And he's like, And then he walks away. And then he's like, oh, shit. And then he goes, sorry, James, I think I screwed up before when you said what Bottle Rocket is. He goes, no, I know what it is. I know why you call it this Bottle Rocket. It's because a bottle rocket is something that fires away from a bottle and it goes up in the air, but then it just goes, poof. And that's what this film is. That's what he said to him, right? And he said, I don't know whether it was a compliment or not, but I took it and then I walked away.
But it's James Caan, so I'll take it.
Right. And that's the thing. So that's why this film here is so cool. And when we saw it, I was like, oh, it's so... It wasn't the same quirk at all. No, it's not at all like the other films.
I think we were expecting a mini Reservoir Dogs when we watched this movie.
That's what we were. But it ended up being kind of... We now know this better because it's about digging into his own Wilson, wow, and his, wow, you know, his brother and his like friend, and they're basically trying to do crime, but they're just dickheads from fucking, you know, the suburbs. They're just little dickheads from the suburbs. But Owen Wilson is doing the his own Wilson is so much that you really buy that he's really earnestly trying to be a criminal, but a successful one, you know. And it's so stupid. They know nothing about crime, and everything turns to shit in this film. But when it does, you're like, that was actually just a great little ride to see how shit they were and that it was funny. And because he had a little bit of style, that's what made it good. So there's your bottle rocket, number 7.
Very nice. All right, my number 7 then is a film from the mid-80s from 1985. It's, I think, John Hughes' only entry into the Criterion Collection. And I think that's an absolute disgrace, to be honest.
Yeah, man.
It's The Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club, baby. I'm surprised to find this on your list.
Really?
No, I didn't think you were this guy at all.
I've gone to the cinema, outdoor cinema, to watch this movie.
I've several times.
I think this is great. So, high school film.
Yeah, but I didn't think you'd be so 80s boy about it. You know what I mean? Like this, I thought you'd be like, The Police was the 80s. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, what? Sorry. I have a thing in my head which is not going to work if I explain it to you. So let's just move on.
So 5 disparate characters. So the nerd, the pretty girl, the alternative girl, the jock, and the outcast.
Judd Nelson.
Yeah, she's the alternative girl.
Yeah, basket case.
They all come together in detention on a Saturday afternoon. As run by, is he the sports teacher? I can't even remember. It's the
principal.
It is principal.
I'm cracking skulls.
It's Paul Gleason. So from from Die Hard. Yep. He would go on to be in Die Hard, playing exactly basically the same character, an asshole.
Yeah.
Who doesn't quite get what's going on? Dwayne T. Robinson, is that his name? Die Hard.
I think so.
And so Emilia Estevez, Anthony Michael Hall, Judd Nelson, Molly Ringwald, Ali Sheedy, and the fact that they realize they're not that different after all. They're all humans and they have some things, if not a lot of things in common, not least of which they fucking hate this principle.
Yeah. Now, this is something that I thought when every time I see this film, I think this, right? There's a scene line in there where they say, Mr. whatever his name is Barry Manilow aware that you raid his wardrobe, right? And I looked at, and what he's wearing is a dark gray suit and a black shirt. And I'm like, fuck, I have that outfit. And I do think that
I've got no problem with wearing darker shirt than my suit or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, I guess it was
my wife gets into me about that too.
Does she? Yeah. I'm a flat collar guy. But like that's the thing. But other than that, because again, this is your 80s films where all the fucking kids look 35. They all look fucking 35.
Well, right? We didn't give a shit in 85.
We didn't give a fuck back then, and this is just the thing, right? So I mean, it's pure warmth, this film. It's pure warmth. And God, I remember thinking when I saw it, like, man, American schools are fucking pimp. They got like floors and shit and libraries and shit. I know, yeah. God, that was a fucking deep cut that I wasn't expecting.
Sorry.
But yes, Aussie high schools don't have gymnasiums as much as Americans want to do. So yeah.
Well, to be fair, Molly Ringwald was 17 when she shot this movie.
Was she?
Yeah.
She didn't look 17 to me. Anyway. Ali Sheedy? She'd be in her 20s at least.
She was 23.
23.
When the film was released. Maybe 22 when the film was shot. So, yeah,
but because of the 80s in this, they look older. You know what I'm saying? Shaggy hair, you know. So, yeah, okay.
And, yeah, pretty impactful soundtrack. And, yeah, I just think this film, I guess I was too young when it came out, but by the time came to appreciate it we were in high school, any kid who's in high school will find something. Even now, I believe, will find something to resonate with them in this because these archetypes, these characters who, again, blend together by the end of the film, that's the message. And
absolutely,
that's really important. And yeah, well done by John Hughes. So yeah.
I had a message. I had a moment with this film. I went to some screening where there was an amphitheater. Mm-hmm. I just went with me and my 10th and girlfriend. And then heaps of people I knew just turned up on that night.
Awesome.
They all separately. And we all had pizza. It was great.
I've watched it outdoors. At a
it makes
well.
A difference. Everyone does the arm punch at the end. The arm punch.
Hey.
Yeah, anyway. So yeah, nice one. Okay, cool. Well, we talked about that enough.
Moving on. Number 6.
Moving on. My number 6 is a real artsy-fartsy film, and look, there's a couple of these guys on here. I went through a Robert Altman phase in my youth, everyone.
Sounds apologetic.
Well,
there's a lot of Robert Altman on this list, right?
There's a lot, and there's two in my list.
It's got to be The Player.
This one's Shortcuts, actually.
Oh,
this one's Shortcuts.
Wrong, I'm sorry.
No, but here's the thing. I remember, this is a 1993 film, and it is basically many loosely connected characters cross paths in one film. They've all got their story. One's a couple, one's another person, one's got a kid, and all this kind of thing. And it's actually Robert Altman's way of putting stories of someone named Raymond Carver all together in a film. It was a pet project of his. And he has people in here like Lyle Lovett.
I don't understand. What do you mean?
There's a writer who does a lot of short stories, and they're just short drama stories.
And they're all his stories.
Yeah, he took them and put them all in a script.
I thought you were saying that was one dude who was common to all these stories, and I never noticed that.
No, that would have been cool. But they all do. It's like one of those Babel movies where everyone's things at the end they sort of come together. When I first saw it, I went, what the fuck is this? It's just a million different things, right? And I was like, I don't know why this is good or bad.
Robert Altman was like,
whoa, 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 hold on.
No, he wasn't, because he's not LeMay as this. But the film itself actually kind of, I saw it again years later, and I'm not sure why, because I knew I didn't like it, but I obviously was forced into it by someone. But
you're mocking me, aren't you?
Once you see it as an old person, right, to look at it and go, oh, the actual theme of the film is this sort of, even though these rich people, it's all about rich people and you're looking on them and stuff like that. It's acknowledgement of shared foibles. Like, no matter who you are or your situation, everyone has fucked up shit going on in their life.
Sure.
And that's what the actual...
Perfect.
Yeah, that's the point of the film. And also, it's the first film where, you know, Julianne Moore?
Heard of her.
She does a whole scene where her flange is out. Just blam! And she's just standing there for
an entire
monologue.
Maybe for the first time in the history of the show, gotten to 40 minutes of recording, even though it might be a little bit shorter by the time I'm editing. 40 minutes of recording without Wayne mentioning anything inappropriate. So well done.
I don't know that it's inappropriate. It was a scene in the film, motherfucker.
Well done.
And you know that, you know, burgers are great. So the... But yes, again, the Robert Altman films actually were known at the time for their improvisational flair, and that's why this movie feels messy, and that's why I like it now, but I didn't when it started. So,
fair
you know.
Enough. Fair enough. Let's move on before we get back to the burger. My number... my number six is the oldest film on my list. It's from 1957. It's 12 Angry Men, directed by Sidney Lumet.
Yeah.
And this one...
You really like this film, don't you?
This is really good.
Yeah.
Have you watched it?
No.
It's literally 12 men who are on a jury for a young man accused of murdering his father.
Mm-hmm.
They go into the room. 11 of them are convinced he's guilty, and Henry Fonda says, nah, yeah. I don't think so. And the film goes from there as he gradually convinces the rest of the jury to side with him. And we have the obvious racist, and we have the, you know, the simpering fool, and these sort of archetypal characters that and how they all interact. And it's must be the cheapest film ever other than the acting talent, because the acting is very good for a 1957 film, I want to say.
So this is a writing triumph, like in terms of, because it's all dialogue and it's all one room.
There's nothing fancy. I mean, the fancy thing you get is camera kind of dolling sideways across the room and racking from one character to another.
Not a thing. Wow. Okay. 12 Angry Men, eh?
Yeah. Absolutely. Highly recommend this film for an acting tour de force. And you're right. This film only works if the writing is top notch. And it is. And it could be a stage play. Maybe it was. How old is it?
57. For it to still be kicking up on lists now, it's obviously the bomb.
4.5 stars on Letterboxd.
You.
I'm dragging it down with my paltry 3.5-4 star average.
Yeah, man, you're fucking up the game. Yep. All right. Well, back to my Altman phase. I will say number 5 is The Player.
So I was right. Okay.
Now, this film has got Tim Robbins, Greta Scacchi, Whoopi Goldberg, a bunch of other people in there, Vincent D'Onofrio. This is about Hollywood and the Hollywood system, okay? And the announcement, what happens is Tim Robbins is this producer, and he's getting these like death threats in the mail, and he tries to track down the dude who gets him the thing, but he ends up killing him, and now he's on the run from the law, but he's still trying to make a film in Hollywood. And all the way through this film, this is like Cameo City, just famous people walk in and out. And it's cool because you're watching the Hollywood system go, right?
A pretty great one shot to start from memory as well.
This is what it was. I watched this because of lit class, okay? Mm. I had a teacher that I liked, and he said,
English
you got to watch
this
film.
English literature, playing at home.
English literature, yes. In high school, and he said, you got to see this film because it's one of the first probably times I saw a filmmaker clever enough to do a scene and then have the dialogue in the scene be actually about the scene. For example, the opening shot is an 8-minute tracking shot, which is just following executives around a company. And the whole time, the guy who's talking and walking is talking about how he hates movies that go cut, 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 cut. I want to see a long scene.
Nice. You know,
shit like that is all in the film. And so it's just smart and funny. And at the time, it shows you why Hollywood is fucked up the way it is, but it somehow makes you throw in.
I watched this one again. I watched this too young. Didn't appreciate it.
Yeah.
I come back to it.
No, you should. It's great work.
Long film, though, from memory.
All Robert Altman shit is fucking 2.5 hours, but it's good.
All right, cool. My number five. Look, here we go. I'm sorry. We're getting to some more familiar territory now. We do talk about this film, but maybe I don't talk about it as much as perhaps. I don't know. Anyway, Robocop. Paul Verhoeven.
Low.
No, 97. I love this movie. It's a sci-fi, over-the-top, gory, dystopian future. This is where we're headed towards if we let things run the way that they're running now and corporations can rule the world and a cop
privatized police forces.
Yeah, cop gets happened. Murdered and then turned back into this killing machine and goes up against bigger killing machines and the crime that underpins all this shit. It is so amazingly over the top for 1987.
You
it's
know,
incredible.
Dude, RoboCop, this is the most amazing thing about RoboCop, okay?
Please.
I saw the trailer for this. I remember sitting in front of the TV with my older sister. We were however young we were, right? Teenagers or whatever, but young teenagers, right? Ad comes on of a dickhead in a fucking metal suit and he's bald and he's saying shit like this. Your move, creep. And fucking dead or alive, you're coming with me, right? And then it's like, we were looking at it going, what the fuck is this? It looks stupid. And then, Paul, the title comes on. RoboCop. They called it RoboCop? And you expect anyone... We were so disdainful for it, right?
Right.
Finally, it comes on. It turns out to be this most amazing, weird, but fucked up, let's face it, movie. And because it's R-rated and it's Paul Verhoeven, the weird shit in it... Like, have you got the bitches leave sign? So...
I feel a little bit sad that I wasn't ready at this particular point.
Bitches leave.
Okay, so shit like that, right? When Clarence Boddicker comes in and
Kurtwood Smith,
that goes inside, and there's a woman there. And he's like, bitches leave, because
bitches leave.
Bitches leave, of course. And then he would like, you know, slowly pull out a grenade and use his tongue to pull out the fucking pin and put it down. And it was really a sadistic film. And the way Murphy gets killed in the beginning,
yeah, it's full on.
Is I was like, I am so affected and triggered by this fucking weird shit. It was really, really harsh. And they let it happen, Paul. They let
80s,
it happen.
Man.
Yes. Yes. It's so weird. And by the way, RoboCop 2 was awesome. And RoboCop 3 sucked.
Yeah. Okay. If you're going to say that RoboCop 3 was good, I was going to be like,
bitches leave.
I don't know, man.
That's obviously we're going to hear that from you. That was my five. So back to you for your four.
Well, my four is where I put The Princess Bride. But let me tell you why it's on here.
Low.
Again.
If you have to have The Princess Bride list, that's low.
No, here's why, all right? Because when I heard about the film, of course, everyone, it is about Fred Savage from The Wonder Years, who is the only actor I knew other than Columbo, who played his grandfather.
Peter Falk, yep.
Comes into the house, reads him a bedtime story. That's novel already, and then it goes into the actual thing, which is fucking Wesley, who's a farmhand, and there's a chick that he's like, you know,
Buttercup.
As you wish, and then that As You Wish turns out to mean I want to put a load in you, and then, right, she gets fucking kidnapped, and he goes, you know, be Dread Pirate Roberts. Everyone knows this film, okay? I'm just going to say to you this, right?
I'm not sure it's As You Wish, but You Wish.
As You Wish.
To put a load in you.
Well, you know what? I really love the idea of a romance which just isn't filthy. You know what I mean? Like all we had was a longing grief and a kiss maybe, you know? Not fucking strap-ons.
Since the beginning of time, there's only been three kisses.
Yes, and one dogging. No, all right. So, but the idea was, I think, that this is an indie-ish film. I know it had big names like Billy Crystal and stuff in it, but I hadn't heard anything about it, okay? And then it became the film in high school, Paul, that you were known to be a sensitive man if the girls knew that you knew this film.
Oh, right.
That's what happened, okay?
Damn, I missed that train.
No, your girlfriend was the woman who was that. Georgia was like, she was impressed that I knew The Princess Bride, and then we talked all about it and stuff like that, right? So this probably got you a little bit of play.
I don't even remember that, to be honest. Damn, might have got me more play had I known.
Well, you know, I mean, oh, by the way, I know a guy who has a t-shirt that says, by the way, ladies, I saw The Notebook and loved it. That's what he wears in bars. And gets women talking to him.
Geez.
I know it's not fair.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so, but anyway, but and that's why this movie means more than just the fact that it was a cool thing. Yes, Inigo Montoya. Yes, all that sort of stuff. Oh. That all that cool Hello. Shit. That
my
made
name is Inigo Montoya.
This is like the A-team.
Kill my father.
Of cool shit.
Prepare to die.
Prepare to die. So, I mean, what can I say? This is the shit over here, and I couldn't leave
the
it off for that reason.
Quote that won Billy, the most quotable film countdown of all time. So, where?
Is that so?
Or the biggest, the best monologue. Best monologue. That's best what monologue. Best monologue. Yes. Well done. So, to be Dizzle. My number four is the Coen Brothers film, early one. I love it. I have spoken about it a couple of times on the show, but it's a very underseen film. 1990s, Miller's Crossing.
Yeah. I almost, that's the other one. I'm like, can I even possibly leave this one if this one's on there? Miller's Crossing is Miller's Crossing, bro.
Yeah. Gabriel Byrne. In the late 1920s, Prohibition era, he works for the Irish gang and the Italian gang are pushing in on them, and he's playing both sides and how this all works out. And Albert Finney's his boss, and Marcia Gay Harden is kind of the woman he's involved with. And then is it John Turturro?
I think it is.
It is.
Look into your heart.
Yeah, look into your heart.
Yeah.
This film belies its relatively low budget with the way that it looks. Some of the shots in this movie are, to this day, stand out in my mind as being some of the most beautiful ever filmed.
And can we give props to the cinematographer, Barry Sonnenfeld?
Yeah, Barry Sonnenfeld, yep.
Because this wasn't... It was good because it was a Joel and Ethan Coen, and look, they're the directors and everything, but that thing looks the way it looks because of Baz, all right?
Yeah, with the wide-angle lenses and the zooming up.
And the slow-mo and the thing. But that is a masterful... If I saw someone like that, that's your DP? Like, fucking... That's what he could do.
No wonder he went on to direct Men in Black.
Exactly. And but fuck, his shit is beautiful, man. In fact, nothing's been as beautiful as... What has he done? Get Shorty was fucking great, but it was cool rather than beautiful. This was beautiful, you know?
Same techniques, but you're kind of getting used to them by that point in time. This was the first time I'd seen it like that before.
And the music had such a big thing to do with it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
I'm sure
that's
we'll
why
feature
it's up
a bit
there.
Of that on this episode. So that's my number four, Miller's Crossing.
Nice one. Everyone, Chasing Amy is my number three.
Yeah, had to be. Had to be.
Of course, dude. Now, everyone, Chasing Amy is it's my favorite Kevin Smith film.
Fair enough.
It's about Holden Bankey, Ben Affleck, and fucking Jason Lee. They're two pals. They're authors of a popular comic book. They're named Holden and Mackie. Yeah, so Holden stumbles on the love of his life, Alyssa, this blonde girl, only to discover that she's gay. And then it becomes... It's ostensibly about the male ego and not being able to contend with dating a girl who's had a past and how to overcome that. And I must say now, being an old man, that it's so ridiculous to me that young men have this hang-up. But I most definitely had it when I was young.
Yeah, really?
Absolutely. Okay. Like, if you feel like, yeah, it's cool. It's like, well, yeah, man, she fucked everyone in this whole crew. And now she's your girlfriend. It's like, whoa, you'd feel weird about it, right? But now I'm like, good. At least she knows what she's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck all you guys.
Guess I got there before you
exactly. You motherfuckers ain't got shit that I got because she stopped with me. Ah! All right, so it's like shit. Anyway, I wouldn't say that exactly.
Things that make you go,
But also than that, this is, I mean, I said that was poor, but this is... Even though I was younger than the characters in this film at the time, when I did get to this 23-year kind of age, this is a little bit like the dark, cool version of what my life was like, because I liked comics. I liked seeing, you know, fucking, you know, young people go to places and they listen to music and they fucking deaf poetry jam and motherfucking comic nights. And hey, my friends...
I thought you were going to say, I like seeing Flange.
No, but I remember going to bars just to hear a band that some guy knew. And that kind of shit. And so that's why this film makes me feel that way.
Enough,
I like love
enough.
That shit. So there you go. Chasing Amy.
My number three is arguably John Woo's greatest film.
Ooh.
Hard Boiled.
Yeah, baby.
On your list?
No.
No, fair enough. Hard Boiled. International action star Chow Yun-Fat. And the aforementioned, I believe, Tony Leung. Yeah.
Yes, he is in this. That's right.
The two
of
them are the opposite sides of, you know, one's the out there, whatever, blah, blah, blah. They join together in one of the ultimate buddy cop films. And
is Hardball the one with the baby?
Yes.
Yeah, the one,
at
right?
the end of the film, and the baby pisses on the fire and puts a fire out and saves
his life.
Yeah,
but he's actually, he's got a baby while he's shooting all these guns and diving through windows. It's like, what the fuck? Whose idea was the baby?
1992, nothing could prepare you for this.
Absolutely
like,
not.
Now, 30 years later, like, okay. But you have to put your mindset in that time. This film literally took our breath away. This was the greatest action movie that had ever been made.
We've never seen anything like it.
I take that with a grain of salt. Die Hard came before this. Die Hard's a better movie than Hard Boiled. But as far as action spectacles go, you couldn't go past this movie. That 25, 30-minute sequence in the hospital at the end of the film is stellar action filmmaking. It's John Woo, the peak, pinnacle John Woo put on film.
He is the one who gave you, like, it basically, you're actually, everything is classy and well done in it. Well, well done anyway. But you're actually shocked as a viewer at the amount of action you're getting.
Yeah.
You're getting 20, 30 minutes of fucking heart-stopping shit. And you're like, what the fuck? You haven't got a chance to breast. And it's so cool because so, that's made his that's his brand.
Yeah, tequila at his,
yeah.
Like this huge action sequence and they're all covered in fucking, I think it's flour or whatever.
Yep.
And the guy who's killed his partner, he's got him under gunpoint,
yep.
just switches the toothpick on the side of his back, blows his head off.
That
blood splatters everywhere.
That is a, that's a style. Yeah. That's a very distinct style that no one saw.
Like he doesn't talk about it, doesn't get it emotional and anguished about it. He's like, tick, tick, fuck this, bam.
Boom, that's it, yeah. And it's so, oh, it's a shock to you as well. Mm-hmm. But then you've already been shocked the whole time. Yeah, but
so it's just, okay, this guy is a bigger badass than all what we just saw. That's everybody right. else. It's set him up now. Guy.
Yep.
It's really brilliant action filmmaking. And I'm so glad it gets honored in the Criterion Collection list because there are very few films. Yes, it's dumb in places. Like a baby's wee puts out a fire that big.
That's just moments. It's like a Jackie Chan film. Those are those funny little, oh, we got to put a little liberty in here because I've been killing 40
Hong
guys.
Kong cinema, right? John Woo.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know what? John Woo is the guy who, I remember us having a conversation when we were kids, like young, who's saying like, oh, yeah, that's right. John Woo never has a clean hero. It's always someone who's a bit bad, and that's why it's great.
Yeah,
and that's and then the
embodied Gray before Gray was cool.
Well, Gray before Gray was cool, and then he pushes that all the way to the limit with Face Off, where literally the bad guy is the good guy. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like it's like, oh shit, that's you know, that's all
only,
the way.
Only what Face Off's only 4 or 5 years after this. So,
yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Cool. Well, my number two is RoboCop. So we're back to your ones.
Damn. All right, my number two. You started. So my number two is, again, this is a film I have talked about a few times. I think it's one of the most influential films ever made. It effectively, not created, but popularized the subgenre. And it was the first sort of, there are other zombie films, but this is the one. This is the one that put it on the map. It gets followed up with Dawn of the Dead in the late 70s and then Day of the Dead. And by then, there's zombie films everywhere, particularly in Italy.
And this one?
1968's Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead.
Written and directed by George A. Romero.
Now, if I recall correctly, you said, or you told me, or...
And John Russo, sorry.
John Russo. So the lead in this film is an African-American.
He is.
In a horror movie.
In 1968.
In 1968. And basically there's like, what? I think the Get Out guy was saying that the only other one is Candyman, which has an African-American lead in a horror film.
Yeah, but
and
in Candyman, oh, you mean now? You mean
yeah, since.
Since, because you're talking about the 2020 or 2021 iteration of Candyman, 2020, I guess.
No, even the 90s one.
Well, Tony Todd's not the lead. Virginia Madsen is in the original one.
Yeah, but like that's...
What
you might call a black horror. I don't know. You mean like...
This is unusual. And Jordan Peele's absolutely right.
Hmm.
Completely unusual. And the best thing about it is George Romero, so I didn't give a shit about skin color. I just cast the best
actor.
That
is most definitely the best thing about this. That is the most...
It wasn't meant to be a politically or
racially...
He wasn't
trying anything. He was just doing this function.
It wasn't subtext. It was just...
Absolutely.
This bloke here, Dwayne Jones, was the best actor. So I cast him.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah. And even though it now resonates, and maybe one of the reasons why 54 years later it still does have such traction is... because of those racial undertones, because Ben's the only one who survives the night of the living dead, you know, trying to crash into this farmhouse where they're holed up. And he's wandering around coming out of the ruins and gets shot by the posse of white sheriffs and gun-toting individuals who are wandering through shooting zombies in the head.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the film. And that's like, bam, fuck you. You thought that was going to be a happy ending? Fuck you. This film takes so many risks and does so much stuff. Even the making of the movie is an absolute handbook on how to do a low budget indie film amongst your friends, right down to like how do you blow up a car safely, except you don't because no one's fucking experienced in doing that.
Did they? And they blew it up?
Yeah.
And it got fucked up.
And thankfully, no one was badly hurt. This is an incredible movie. As I said, it gives rise to the whole zombie horror subgenre. It's one of the most important
films. Sounds like it's really ahead of its time, like
I think
in like a whole bunch of ways.
Yep. I think so. And shot in black and white, 1968, it didn't need to be. So, hats off. George A. Romero's Night Living Dead in my number two.
Nice one. That's it, bro. So, 10 to 1 now.
Please.
My 10 was Police Story. 9, In the Mood for Love. 8, Watership Down. 7, Bottle Rocket. 6, Shortcuts. 5, The Player. 4, Princess Bride, 3, Chasing Amy, 2, RoboCop, and 1 is... I've definitely talked about this before, but you all know I love it, and I could not make it here. It's The Game. It's The Game.
I shopped it off for that later.
Okay.
My honorable mentions talk about it too much.
Okay, good. So, but let me tell you something about this. Right? Very quickly, The Game is about Michael Douglas. He's a rich, successful banker. His name's Nicholas. Keeps to himself. His brother, Sean Penn, comes on his birthday with a gift and says, yo, if you participate in this personalized real-life game, it'll make you fun, make your life fun. He reluctantly accepts, and then the game grows increasingly personal. And it becomes this cat and mouse shit, and his life's in danger and that kind of shit. Now, I actually find this David Fincher's trickiest thriller because it's actually kind of giving you a few different aspects to this character. Yes, you're watching that this company is controlling his life. And the more you invest in his welfare, the more you're displaying your complicitness with just rich people who actually have this... who are rich enough to have a game like this, which obviously costs hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars just as a birthday present.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also watching a film, but you're also seeing this company literally almost creating a film. Like, they had to write the story that they're going to put his game in. They didn't film it, but they have to get all their characters in place, and they have to come back to a certain, like, conclusion to actually force him to do that. And it's kind of cool, man. So, like, this is why I've always loved the film. Plus, I just think it's really exciting and works almost all the time. The only thing that doesn't work, no, it works at the end. The thing.
Yeah, it looks fine. It's fine. Yeah. It doesn't really work when you think about it too hard, but it's fine.
Well, he had to jump off that side of the building is the only thing that they didn't necessarily take care of. But it's still great, trust me. So The Game, if you haven't seen it, you gotta check it out. But if you heard me talking about this,
25 years ago.
25 years ago. It seems like
dang.
I know.
Damn. All right. My 10 through 2 then. Really, my number 1 at number 10, this is Spinal Tap. Tap, 9, Videodrome, 8, The Grand Budapest Hotel, 7, The Breakfast Club, 6, 12, Angry Man, 5, RoboCop, 4, Miller's Crossing, 3, Hard Boiled, 2, Night of the Living Dead, and number 1. Again, a film I do talk about a bit, but not as much as the ones that I've shopped off my list. It is a foreign language film from Guillermo del Toro. It's Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, I was wondering if that's where it would go.
2006. Look, I just couldn't. I think this film is... as far as I'm concerned, the quintessential Criterion Collection film. It's not...
it's a foreign movie. It's like, you know, it's foreign movie. Yeah.
It's got multiple ways you can view this movie. It's incredibly well shot. The production design is excellent. The performances are top notch.
Mm-hmm.
Even the way it's lensed with the color scheme that it has through the Spanish Civil War and the perspective of this poor girl, Ophelia, and what she has to go through living with her mom and this stepfather who is this absolute... horrendous individual.
Do you know if he wrote this?
Yes.
Yeah, he probably did because he's like, he's an auteur.
Written, directed, and partially produced by Guillermo del Toro. So,
do you know I think about this film, right? This is the raw version. His most professional version of this type of movie is The Shape of Water.
I disagree.
See,
it
I
might
think,
be better filmed.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It's the best looking version
of this.
It's
not a better story. For me, this is by far a better film.
This is a harder hitting movie, whereas The Shape of the Water is more my thing, if you know what I mean. But look, I agree. This is definitely the harsher one, and I always choose to believe it was real because I want to be happy.
And you want to talk about creature designs, this film is next level. Between the
this is the start of where he started to do all of his things, where he's putting eyes on your hands and shit like that,
it's actually, The Devil's Backbone came before this, but yeah, that was just another Criterion Collection movie
but
as
well.
But
they look the same, you know, it's like Hellboy, one of the characters in Hellboy looks exactly like the Shape of Water alien.
Right.
You know, and like this, and a few of them look David a little Harvey like is. This one, yep. you know, so yep. it's, yeah, he's creased.
Great film, and probably talk about it enough, so we'll stop there. That's my number one. Wayne, we mentioned some honorable mentions. I'll just run through mine.
Go ahead.
The Princess Bride, I said Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
You said The Game, and I said The Rock. That were my next four.
Cool.
Or it would have been on my list, all of them, probably, if we hadn't talked about them so much.
Only ones I thought of that we haven't mentioned is Blowout, Shallow Grave,
yep.
The Fisher King.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, I love The Fisher King. Ooh. Jeff Bridges is great, man. Fucking Warren Williams is great, man.
Nothing for me. I have to watch it again.
Really? Because I thought, oh no, he's insane. That's it.
Okay, that's Alice. What about yours? We wrap up every episode of the show with your feedback on the topic at hand, the segment that we call the Pop 10.
Talk about
Pop 10.
Talk about
Pop 10.
Kicking off this week's Pop 10 with Jesse Dixon, who said, in terms of their top 10 Criterion films, The Royal Tenenbaums at number 3.
Hmm.
Number 2, The Great Dictator from Charlie Chaplin.
See, this is some classic ass shit right here.
Number 1, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Ooh, damn, I didn't even see that one on there if I'm honest.
Hmm.
John Huslander said, so many issues from going to go for a variety here. Number three, Godzilla from 1954. I have a soft spot for the big guy on really? The score. It's a classic. Number two, The Life of Brian. For comedy, it's hard to choose between this and Spinal Tap, but I'm going with MP, Monty Python. If for no other reason than the closing song.
Yeah.
Always look on the bright side. Number one, Silence of the Lambs, the rare case of a movie that matched my image of the book. That's very good.
Agreed. That was almost the one.
Jonathan Lamb said, number three, Chungking Express is probably my favorite Wong Kar-wai film, and it's such a romantic film.
Hmm.
Number two, Throne of Blood, Kira Kurosawa film, such a gripping and timeless classic, best adaptation, Macbeth?
Okay.
And number one, Parasite. This film is pure genius on so many levels. World cinema at its finest. Yeah, that's probably could have been one of the reasons. Recency effect and bias.
Again, yep.
David Lowe said, number three, Zodiac.
Yeah, man.
Number two, Blue Velvet. Ooh, David Lynch.
Do you know what that movie's supposed to be about?
No.
Apparently it's supposed to be hell. He's really? Depicting hell. And Dennis Hopper's like just the worst guy ever. You know, it's like that's
David Lynch. Yep. Yeah. Not for me. But Daniel's number one is for me On the Waterfront with an excellent, excellent Marlon Brando in the lead. Yeah, great film. Well worth watching. Mark Ellis Reagans from the So Is It podcast. Normally talk about Joey. This week, Mark Ellis gets the nod number three, Notorious. Number two, Hard Boiled. Number one, Do the Right Thing.
Really?
Spike Lee's classic. Dan Brennick from the Netflix and Swill podcast, who's fresh off the live stream for the Cure tech support. Once again, congratulations to Nick.
Nice work, kids.
And Gerald on $23,000. $1,000 raised. American dollars, by the way. Raised for the fight against cancer. He said he's seen 24, so you've beaten Dan.
Oh, word.
Woo. Number three, Parasite. Number two, 12 Angry Men. And number one, Beast of No Nation. I should have had that on my honorable mentions as well. Nice choice, Dan. Michelle Dodo said, Dazed and Confused. Surprised that wasn't on yours, man.
I liked it fine.
The Princess Bride and The Breakfast Club. Josh Ragland said, Moonrise Kingdom, Parasite, and Rushmore. So a lot of Wes Anderson love that one. Connell Tobin Mike McNeil said, number three, Princess Bride. Number two, Dazed and Confused. Number one, Bull Durham,
yeah. Great show.
And the man himself who created this topic today, it's Jan Filion Survey. So number 10, Maya Winnipeg. We're going to be a lot of me pausing and not knowing what movie you're talking about here. It's Jan. So,
oh, yeah, this motherfucker, Etchon knows a lot of like odd Hollywood,
he is
obscure.
Yeah. Number 9, Do the Right Thing. 8, Safe. 7, My Darling Clementine. 6, Female Trouble.
Damn.
5, David Lynch's Eraserhead.
Yeah.
Number four, Beau Travail.
Damn.
Number three, A Brighter Summer Day. Number two, Dreams. Number one, Nashville. There's your list of films.
I knew fucking two of those.
To watch. If you're a listener of this show who wants to expand their appreciation for cinema, it's John. Thank you very, very much.
Very impressive, old man.
For the topic, for your support of the show. If you want to get involved, I don't think there's any spots left in the top level. We've peaked at that level.
Maybe we'll let a few of them.
If you really want to, let us know. We'll open it up. But realistically speaking, we really, truly appreciate all the support of the show that we get. And from the top level patrons, there is no greater support you can provide. Except for, I have to say, Wayne, Manscaped.
Oh, yes. Everyone, I don't know if you've ever had your balls. I don't know, obviously, they'd be shaved and clean with a Manscaped unit because it's so awesome. But then you put them motherfuckers in underwear that has a pouch for your balls.
The jewel
pouch? A ball pouch, everyone. The jewel pouch. Tell us about the jewel pouch, Paul.
Oh, it's a brand new set of boxes. Boxes 2.0 from the mad geniuses at Manscaped, who went, you know what? What men don't like, they do not like having their balls slapping against the side of their thighs and creating a whole bunch of friction unnecessarily.
This, of course, means that if you're wearing the Boxers 2.0 with the jewel pouch, everyone who sees them is just going to assume that you're trimmed.
Yes.
Trimmed nicely.
Why wouldn't they?
Because it's from Manscaped. And if you want to get a Manscaped unit and some boxers, all you got to do to get 20% off and free shipping is hit manscaped.com, go make your order, and put in the code CDPC20 at checkout to just get 20% off the whole thing.
And as you said, free shipping. You can do that for the Boxers 2.0. You can do that for the Lawnmower 4.0, which is how you get the very close
basically the best bull and hair clipping apparatus ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's the bomb.
More and more, we keep hearing from these testimonials from our listeners.
Yes, the actual listeners are like, yo.
The closest shave I've ever had down there.
That's right.
Without causing any undue nicks, nor indeed blood. Because we don't want to see blood down there. That's not what we're looking for at all.
All we want is gleaming fucking balls, man.
And you can get the whole thing, including, I don't know, to be honest, I'm not quite sure whether the box is 2.0 in there as well, but you can get a whole thing, including boxes, the performance package. It is the 4.0 lawnmower. It is the boxes. It is the ball spritzer, the ball deodorant.
Everything.
It is the nose and hair and ear.
And the cool fucking carrying bag that comes with it. It's fucking sweet.
It is sweet ass. So there we are. That's what you can do over at manscaped.com, which we are in a paid partnership with. Thank you so much to the Manscaped people for facilitating this.
Word.
All right, that's it from us today, really, for episode 374. Next week, Wayne, what are we doing for episode 375?
Not sure, Cracker.
Why don't I hit the music that allows us to happen?
No, I got it, okay. All right, I got it, motherfucker, Jesus. Next week, everyone, we are doing the top 10 final shots in films.
Ooh.
And this is a topic that's come to us from one of our beloved, many beloved patrons.
Our couple beloved patrons.
Couple beloved. It's
Kevin and Trisha Lawler.
That's right.
Out people of New York.
Damn right. Great taste in art, these two.
Yeah. Oh, also, you may be able to tell. Wayne has a nice side art business. If you want something drawn by him, let us know.
Oh, yeah. I think you'd love it.
Thank you, Kevin and Trisha, for this topic. They said either final lines or final shots. We've got to go for final shots.
Final shots in a film.
Because that makes much more sense on an audible podcast medium.
We'll make it work.
We will indeed. All right, Wayne, how do the fans / people who listen get in touch with us about the show or anything they want to ask?
Sure. Once you bounce from the countdownpodcast.com because I haven't made it good yet, you can go search for our socials on Google or give us an email at thecountdownpodcast@gmail.com.
Podbean.com is where we host. Follow the show, like and follow the show there, and the Countless community link is in the shows. And also, hey, hit us up. Give us a review. Give us 5 stars. That's the way. That's the trading. You know, any less than 5 stars by saying this is shit. 5 stars on shut up on whatever podcast being you listen to us, and we will greatly appreciate your input into the show. Can't afford Patreon, can't afford Manscaped. That's fine. You can afford maybe, you know, 30 seconds of your time. That's
sure.
All we ask for. Thank you so much. And that's it from us today. Episode 373 of the count. 74 of the countdown, right?
374.
Done and dusted. Thank you so much for your patronage and listenership. My name is Paul.
My name is Wayne.
And this has been The Soundboard.
Suck it.
Would have been over a lot quicker had you not added to it, but it's fine. But that's it, boss. Catch you later. See ya.
Bitches leave.